From NPR News in Washington, I'm Jennifer Ludden, and this is Special Coverage. We're waiting for President Barack Obama, who will hold a news conference in a few moments from the Brady Press Briefing Room at the White House. It's his first news conference this year, and the president is expected to announce plans that would help borrowers with government-insured mortgages. Previous efforts to help homeowners fell below expectations, and this is the president's latest effort to address the housing crisis. The president's approval ratings have been inching up recently, but despite some small signs that the economy is improving, rising gasoline prices are threatening to slow the economy. The president is also expected to answer questions about Iran's nuclear program and his meeting with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu yesterday, as well as the escalating civil unrest in Syria. I'm joined here in Studio 4B by NPR's national political correspondent, Mara Liasson. And Mara, today is Super Tuesday. We've got voters in 10 states choosing among Republican candidates for the presidency. Why do you think Mr. Obama chose today for this news conference?
Just a coincidence, they say at the White House. This is called counter-programming. We've got a lot of attention being paid to the Republicans, and everybody's going to the polls. So why shouldn't President Obama take advantage of this kind of nice dead space during the day before the poll results come in and get a little attention for himself? He hasn't had a full-fledged news conference since November in Hawaii for the AIPAC meeting. So it's about time to have one. And what better time than to take some attention away from Republicans if possible?
And the housing plan, is that his main goal here?
The housing plan is the policy nugget that they have come up with to put at the beginning of this press conference. Usually he has some remarks about some kind of domestic economic issue, and today it's housing. And what he's going to announce is that there are going to be new steps to provide housing relief to veterans and service members, helping them if they have been abused in a foreclosure process, also giving them some mortgage relief. He's also going to announce that the FHA, the Federal Housing Authority, actually, you know what? I don't know if that is the right acronym. But anyway, it's the FHA-backed mortgages. This is a federal insurance entity. They currently charge an upfront mortgage insurance premium of 1%. They're going to reduce that to 0.01%. And the White House says this could help 2 to 3 million FHA borrowers and give them about $1,000 a year.
All right. So we'll hear more about that in a few moments. But the president is no doubt going to get lots of questions on various foreign policy crises at the moment. We're also joined by NPR's foreign affairs correspondents Michelle Kellerman and Tom Gelton. Michelle, this comes as the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee is meeting here in Washington. And Mr. Obama had a big meeting with Israel's prime minister yesterday. What did we learn from that?
Well, that's right. It is a very politically charged time on this issue. On Iran, the two men met for several hours yesterday. They didn't seem to come very much closer on what to do about keeping nuclear weapons out of the hands of Iranians. President Obama said both men prefer diplomacy. And Netanyahu at AIPAC, the pro-Israel lobby last night, said Israel can't wait much longer. We did have some news on the diplomatic front today. The European Union's foreign policy chief, Catherine Ashton, responded to Iran's nuclear negotiator and said that the Europeans, the U.S., Russia, and China are ready to open new talks with Iran on the nuclear program. So we might expect to hear what President Obama expects out of that. Diplomats say they want this to be a step-by-step approach that tests Iran along the way and that the onus is on Iran to prove that its program is peaceful. We'll see if that is going to satisfy Netanyahu as well.
Well, the Americans have been making the case that they've got sanctions put in place and they should wait and let those work. Tom, where are the sanctions right now?
Well, Jennifer, the sanctions, what we're seeing with respect to Iran are really pretty much the toughest sanctions the world has ever seen, and really effective. I mean, these sanctions have brought the Iranian economy into a steep downturn. The Iranian currency is losing its value. The European Union is on schedule to cut off all purchases of Iranian oil by July. The United States is on schedule to punish foreign firms that do business with the Central Bank of Iran. Those sanctions would take effect at the end of June. Already in anticipation of these sanctions taking effect, we see firms cutting back, even before they're required to cut back. We also are seeing Western insurance companies refusing to insure tankers that carry Iranian oil for fear that they're going to run into trouble. So the administration argues, and it's a sound argument, that these sanctions are really hurting. Now, what they say then is that this we need to give time for these sanctions to really take full effect and to see what impact they have. There's an open question, as Michelle said, about whether the Israelis are willing to wait that long. But it is clear that these sanctions really are hurting.
All right. Syria is another issue that's no doubt going to come up. Yesterday, we had Senator John McCain call for the U.S. to carry out airstrikes to help push President Bashar al-Assad out of power there. Mara, what has been the reaction so far in Washington to that?
Well, the White House says, by the way, I just want to correct earlier, I said the Federal Housing Authority, it's the Federal Housing Administration. But in any event, the White House has said that this Syria is not yet analogous to Libya. In other words, it's not the situation there is not conducive to military action from outside, and that they think the call for Assad to step down and the other kinds of sanctions and international coalition efforts they're making is the right way to go. It's interesting because John McCain, who is calling for this from the Senate, is not being echoed by the Republican candidates out on the campaign trail. Although they're very critical of the president in general on Syria, they're not saying, let's go to war.
Hmm. And Michelle, what about in the international community? I mean, is there any support among other countries for this kind of action?
You know, the State Department's really been focusing on, as Mara said, sanctions, pressure on Assad, and trying to get humanitarian aid into the country. So you might see some aid going into to the opposition that way. But, you know, Russia, China vetoed a resolution that was watered down. So I don't think anyone would expect the international community to approve something like what McCain was suggesting.
Tom?
The other issue, of course, is whether the international other countries should provide arms to the Syrian rebels. There is more support for that, although on this issue, too, there's a division of opinion. Some Arab countries, Saudi Arabia, for example, seems to be disposed to this. Other countries are worried that you don't know who you're arming there. The Syrian rebels are a very fragmented group. There are clearly some radical Islamist groups embedded within that force, and do you really want to arm them? They've already been carrying out suicide attacks against Syrian government forces. This is reminiscent of what the Sunni radicals in Iraq were doing against the Iraqi government. So there's a scenario there that makes some people nervous. So for that reason, there's not unanimity about arming the Syrian rebels, just as there is not unanimity by a long shot about actually carrying out airstrikes.
And this is a president who campaigned on winding down foreign wars, but then had this very successful kind of venture from a distance in Libya.
In Libya, actually, in some ways, what McCain is talking about is more reminiscent of Bosnia than it is of Libya, because he's talking about establishing safe havens, which is what was established in Bosnia, where you actually would designate certain areas where refugees could settle that would be then protected by international authority as a safe haven, as opposed to actually trying to assist them as they take on the government forces throughout the country.
All right, and here is President Barack Obama, his first news conference.
Good afternoon, everybody. Now, I understand there are some political contests going on tonight, but I thought I'd start the day off by taking a few questions, which I'm sure will not be political in nature. But before I do, I want to make a few announcements about some steps we're taking to help responsible homeowners who've been struggling through this housing crisis. Now, we've clearly seen some positive economic news over the last few months. Businesses have created about 3.7 million new jobs over the last 2 years. Manufacturers are hiring for the first time since the 1990s. The auto industry is back and hiring more than 200,000 people over the last few years. Confidence is up, and the economy is getting stronger. But there are still millions of Americans who can't find a job. There are millions more who are having a tough time making the rent or the mortgage, paying for gas or groceries. So our job in Washington isn't to sit back and do nothing, and it's certainly not to stand in the way of the recovery. Right now, we've got to do everything we can to speed it up. Now, Congress did the right thing when they passed part of my jobs plan and prevented a tax hike on 160 million working Americans this year, and that was a good first step. But it's not enough. They can't just stop there and wait for the next election to come around. There are a few things they can do right now that could make a real difference in people's lives. This Congress should, once and for all, end tax breaks for companies that are shipping jobs overseas and use that money to reward companies that are creating jobs here in the United States. I've put forward a proposal that does just that, and there's no reason why Congress can't come together and start acting on it. This Congress could hold a vote on the Buffett rule so that we don't have billionaires paying a lower tax rate than their secretaries. That's just common sense. The vast majority of Americans believe it's common sense, and if we're serious about paying down our deficit, it's as good a place to start as any. And finally, this Congress should pass my proposal to give every responsible homeowner a chance to save an average of $3,000 a year by refinancing their mortgage at historically low rates. No red tape, no runaround from the banks. If you've been on time on your payments, if you've done the right thing, if you've acted responsibly, you should have a chance to save that money on your home, perhaps to build up your equity or just have more money in your pocket that you can spend on businesses in your community. That would make a huge difference for millions of American families. Now, if Congress refuses to act, I've said that I'll continue to do everything in my power to act without them. Last fall, we announced an initiative that allows millions of responsible homeowners to refinance at low interest rates. Today, we're taking it a step further. We are cutting by more than half the refinancing fees that families pay for loans insured by the Federal Housing Administration. That's going to save the typical family in that situation an extra $1,000 a year on top of the savings that they'd also receive from refinancing. That would make refinancing even more attractive to more families. It's like another tax cut that'll put more money in people's pockets. We're going to do this on our own. We don't need congressional authorization to do it. We're also taking a series of steps to help homeowners who have served our country. It is unconscionable that members of our armed forces and their families have been some of those who have been most susceptible to losing their homes due to the actions of unscrupulous banks and mortgage lenders. Over the last few years, that happened a lot. So as part of the landmark settlement we reached with some of the nation's largest banks a few weeks ago, here's what we're going to do. If you are a member of the armed forces whose home was wrongfully foreclosed, you will be substantially compensated for what the bank did to you and your family. If you are a member of the armed forces with a high interest rate who was wrongfully denied the chance to lower it while you were in active service, which banks are required to do by law, the banks will refund you the money you would have saved along with a significant penalty. The settlement will make sure that you aren't forced into foreclosure just because you have a permanent change in station, but can't sell your home because you owe more than it's worth. Some of the money will also go into a fund that guarantees loans on favorable terms to our veterans. And there will be more foreclosure protections for every man and woman who is currently serving this country in harm's way. As I've said before, no amount of money is going to be enough to make it right for a family who has had their piece of the American dream wrongfully taken away from them. And no action, no matter how meaningful, will entirely heal our housing market on its own. This is not something the government by itself can solve. But I'm not one of those people who believe that we should just sit by and wait for the housing market to hit bottom. There are real things that we can do right now that would make a substantial difference in the lives of innocent, responsible homeowners. That's true in housing, and that's true in any number of different areas when it comes to ensuring that this recovery touches as many lives as possible. That's going to be my top priority as long as I hold this office, and I will do everything I can to make that progress. So with that, I'm going to take some questions, and I will start with Mike Vicara.
Yes, sir. On the Middle East and as it relates to American politics, a little less than a year ago, Muammar Gaddafi gave a speech and he said he was going to send his forces to Benghazi. He was going to rout opponents from their bedrooms and he was going to shoot them. You frequently cited that speech as a justification for NATO, the no-fly zone, and military action against Libya. In Syria, Bashar al-Assad is killing people. There's a massacre underway. And your critics here in the United States, including most notably John McCain, said you should start airstrikes now. And on Iran, Mitt Romney on Sunday went so far as to say that if you are reelected, Iran will get a bomb and the world will change. How do you respond to this criticism?
All right, Mike, you asked a couple of questions there, so let me... Let's start with the Iran situation, since that's been the topic of the news for the last few days. When I came into office, Iran was unified, on the move, had made substantial progress on its nuclear program, and the world was divided in terms of how to deal with it. What we've been able to do over the last 3 years is mobilize unprecedented, crippling sanctions on Iran. Iran is feeling the bite of these sanctions in a substantial way. The world is unified. Iran is politically isolated. And what I have said is that we will not countenance Iran getting a nuclear weapon. My policy is not containment. My policy is to prevent them from getting a nuclear weapon, because if they get a nuclear weapon, that could trigger an arms race in the region. It would undermine our nonproliferation goals. It could potentially fall into the hands of terrorists. And we've been in close consultation with all our allies, including Israel, in moving this strategy forward. At this stage, it is my belief that we have a window of opportunity where this can still be resolved diplomatically. That's not just my view. That's the view of our top intelligence officials. It's the view of top Israeli intelligence officials. And as a consequence, we are going to continue to apply the pressure even as we provide a door for the Iranian regime to walk through where they could rejoin the community of nations by giving assurances to the international community that they're meeting their obligations and they are not pursuing a nuclear weapon. That's my track record. Now, what's said on the campaign trail? You know, those folks don't have a lot of responsibilities. They're not commander-in-chief. And when I see the casualness with which some of these folks talk about war, I'm reminded of the costs involved in war. I'm reminded of the decision that I have to make in terms of sending our young men and women into battle and the impacts that has on their lives, the impact it has on our national security, the impact it has on our economy. This is not a game. There's nothing casual about it. And, you know, when I see some of these folks who have a lot of bluster and a lot of big talk, but when you actually ask them specifically what they would do, it turns out they repeat the things that we've been doing over the last 3 years. It indicates to me that that's more about politics than actually trying to solve a difficult problem. Now, the one thing that we have not done is we haven't launched a war. If some of these folks think that it's time to launch a war, they should say so. And they should explain to the American people exactly why they would do that and what the consequences would be. Everything else is just talk.
It goes to Syria as well.
With respect to Syria, what's happening in Syria is heartbreaking and outrageous. And what you've seen is the international community mobilize against the Assad regime. And it's not a question of when Assad leaves or if Assad leaves. It's a question of when. He has lost the legitimacy of his people. And the actions that he's now taking against his own people is inexcusable, and the world community has said so in a more or less unified voice. On the other hand, for us to take military action unilaterally, as some have suggested, or to think that somehow there is some simple solution, I think is a mistake. What happened in Libya was we mobilized the international community, had a UN Security Council mandate had the full cooperation of the region, Arab states, and we knew that we could execute very effectively in a relatively short period of time. This is a much more complicated situation. So what we've done is to work with key Arab states, key international partners. Hillary Clinton was in Tunisia, to come together and to mobilize and plan how do we support the opposition, how do we provide humanitarian assistance, how do we continue the political isolation, how do we continue the economic isolation. And we are going to continue to work on this project with other countries. And it is my belief that ultimately this dictator will fall as dictators in the past have fallen. But the notion that the way to solve every one of these problems is to deploy our military, that hasn't been true in the past, and it won't be true now. We've got to think through what we do through the lens of what's going to be effective, but also what's critical for U.S. security interests. Jake Tapper.
Thank you, Mr. President. What kind of assurances did you give Prime Minister Netanyahu about the role that the U.S. would play if diplomacy and economic sanctions fail to work to convince Iran's leaders to change their behavior and Israel goes ahead and prepares to strike their nuclear facilities? What kind of assurances did you tell him? And shouldn't we, I recognize the difference between debate and bluster, but shouldn't we be having in this country a vigorous debate about what could happen in the case of a Middle East war in a way that, sadly, we did not do before going into Iraq?
Well, I think there's no doubt that those who are suggesting or proposing or beating the drums of war should explain clearly to the American people what they think the costs and benefits would be. I'm not one of those people, because what I've said is that we have a window through which we can resolve this issue peacefully. We have put forward an international framework that is applying unprecedented pressure. The Iranians just stated that they are willing to return to the negotiating table, and we've got the opportunity, even as we maintain that pressure, to see how it plays out. I'm not going to go into the details of my conversation with Prime Minister Netanyahu, but what I said publicly doesn't differ greatly from what I said privately. Israel is a sovereign nation that has to make its own decisions about how best to preserve its security. And as I said over the last several days, I am deeply mindful of the historical precedents that weigh on any prime minister of Israel when they think about the potential threats to Israel and the Jewish homeland. What I have also said is that because sanctions are starting to have significant effect inside of Iran, and that's not just my assessment, that's, I think, a uniform assessment, because the sanctions are going to be even tougher in the coming months, because they're now starting to affect their oil industry, their central bank, and because we're now seeing noises about them returning to the negotiating table, that it is deeply in everybody's interests, the United States, Israel, and the world's, to see if this can be resolved in a peaceful fashion. And so this notion that somehow we have a choice to make in the next week or 2 weeks or month or 2 months is not borne out by the facts. And the argument that we've made to the Israelis is that we have made an unprecedented commitment to their security. There is an unbreakable bond between our two countries. But one of the functions of friends is to make sure that we provide honest and unvarnished advice in terms of what is the best approach to achieve a common goal, particularly one in which we have a stake. This is not just an issue of Israeli interest. This is an issue of U.S. interest. It's also not just an issue of consequences for Israel if action is taken prematurely. There are consequences to the United States as well. And so I do think that any time we consider military action, that the American people understand there's going to be a price to pay. Sometimes it's necessary. But we don't do it casually. You know, when I visit Walter Reed, when I sign letters to families that haven't whose loved ones have not come home, I am reminded that there is a cost. Sometimes we bear that cost, but we think it through. We don't play politics with it. When we have in the past, when we haven't thought it through, and it gets wrapped up in politics, we make mistakes. And typically it's not the folks who are popping off who pay the price. It's these incredible men and women in uniform and their families who pay the price. And as a consequence, I think it's very important for us to take a careful, thoughtful, sober approach to what is a real problem. And that's what we've been doing over the last 3 years. That's what I intend to keep doing.
Sir, I'm so sorry. If I could just quickly follow up. Jake, you might not be beating the drums of war, but you did very publicly say, we've got Israel's back. What does that mean?
What it means is that historically we have always cooperated with Israel with respect to the defense of Israel, just like we do with a whole range of other allies, just like we do with Great Britain, just like we do with Japan. That broad statement, I think, is confirmed when you look at what we've done over the last 3 years on things like Iron Dome that prevents missiles from raining down on their small towns along border regions of Israel that potentially land on schools or children or families. And we're going to continue that unprecedented security commitment. It was not a military doctrine that we were laying out for any particular military action. It was a restatement of our consistent position that the security of Israel is something I deeply care about, and that the deeds of my administration over the last 3 years confirms how deeply we care about it. That's a commitment we've made. Jackie. Where's Jackie? There you are.
With the news this morning that the U.S. and its allies are returning to the table or taking up Iran's offer to talk again, more than a year after those talks broke up in frustration, is this Iran's last chance to negotiate an end to this nuclear question? And you said 3 years ago, nearly 3 years ago, in a similar one-on-one meeting with Prime Minister Netanyahu, that the time for talk, by the end of that year, 2009, you would be considering whether Iran was negotiating in good faith. And you said at that time that we're not going to have talks forever. So here we are nearly 3 years later. Is this it? And did you think you would be here 3 years after those first talks?
You know, there is no doubt that over the last 3 years, when Iran has engaged in negotiations, there has been hemming and hawing and stalling and avoiding the issues in ways that the international community has concluded were not serious. And my expectations, given the consequences of inaction for them, the severe sanctions that are now being applied, the huge toll it's taking on their economy, the degree of isolation that they're feeling right now, which is unprecedented, they understand that the world community means business. To resolve this issue will require Iran to come to the table and discuss in a clear and forthright way how to prove to the international community that the intentions of their nuclear program are peaceful. They know how to do that. This is not a mystery. And so it's going to be very important to make sure that on an issue like this, there are complexities. It obviously has to be methodical. I don't expect a breakthrough in a first meeting, but I think we will have a pretty good sense fairly quickly as to how serious they are about resolving the issue. And there are steps that they can take that would send a signal to the international community and that are verifiable, that would allow them to be in compliance with international norms, in compliance with international mandates, abiding by the Non-Proliferation Treaty, and provide the world an assurance that they're not pursuing a nuclear weapon. They know how to do it. And the question is going to be whether in these discussions they show themselves moving clearly in that direction. Ed Henry.
Thank you, Mr. President. I wanted to follow up on Israel and Iran because you have said repeatedly you have Israel's back. So I wonder why 3 years in office you have not visited Israel as president. And related to Iran and Israel, you have expressed concern about this loose talk of war, as you call it, driving up gas prices further. Your critics will say on Capitol Hill that you want gas prices to go higher because you have said before that will wean the American people off fossil fuels onto renewable fuels. How do you respond to that?
Ed, just from a political perspective, do you think the President of the United States going into re-election wants gas prices to go up higher? Is there anybody here who thinks that makes a lot of sense? Here's the bottom line with respect to gas prices. I want gas prices lower because they hurt families. Because I meet folks every day who have to drive a long way to get to work, and them filling up this gas tank gets more and more painful and is a tax out of their pocketbooks, out of their paychecks. And a lot of folks are already operating on the margins right now. And it's not good for the overall economy, because when gas prices go up, consumer spending oftentimes pulls back. And we're in the midst right now of a recovery that is starting to build up steam, and we don't want to reverse it. What I have also said about gas prices is that there is no silver bullet, and the only way we're going to solve this problem over the medium and long term is with an all-of-the-above strategy that says we're going to increase production, which has happened. We are going to make sure that we are conserving energy. That's why we doubled fuel efficiency standards on cars, which will save consumers about $1.7 trillion and take about 12 billion barrels of oil offline, which will help to reduce prices. And we're going to develop clean energy technologies that allow us to continue to use less oil. And we've made progress. I mean, the good news is 2010, first time in a decade that our oil imports were actually below 50%, and they have kept on going down. And we're going to keep on looking at every strategy we can to, yes, reduce the amount of oil that we use while maintaining our living standards and maintaining our productivity and maintaining our economic growth. And we're going to do everything we can to make sure that consumers aren't hurt by it. Now, there's some short-term steps that we're looking at with respect to, for example, there are certain potential bottlenecks in refineries around the country that we've been concerned about. We're concerned about what's happening in terms of production around the world. It's not just what's happening in the Gulf. You've had, for example, in Sudan, some oil that's been taken offline that's helping to restrict supply. So we're going to look at a whole range of measures, including, by the way, making sure that my attorney general is paying attention to potential speculation in the oil markets. I've asked him to reconstitute a task force that's examining that. But we go through this every year. We've gone through this for 30 years. And if we are going to be competitive, successful, and make sure families are protected over the long term, then we've got to make sure that we've got a set of options that reduce our overall dependence on oil. Now, with respect to Israel, I'm not the first president who has been unable, because of a whole range of issues, not to visit Israel as president in their first term. I visited Israel twice as senator, once right before I became president. The measure of my commitment to Israel is not measured by a single visit. The measure of my commitment to Israel is seen in the actions that I've taken as President of the United States, and it is indisputable that I've had Israel's back over the last 3 years. I'm Amir Madani.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Yeah.
Do you believe Rush Limbaugh's apology to the Georgetown law student was sufficient and heartfelt? Do you agree with the decision of the growing number of sponsors that have decided to drop his show, stop supporting his show? And has there been a double standard on this issue? Liberal commentators have made similarly provocative or distasteful statements, and there hasn't been such an outrage.
You know, I'm not going to comment on what sponsors decide to do. I'm not going to comment on either the economics or the politics of it. I don't know what's in Rush Limbaugh's heart, so I'm not going to comment on the sincerity of his apology. What I can comment on is the fact that all decent folks can agree that the remarks that were made don't have any place in the public discourse. And, you know, the reason I called Ms. Flew is because I thought about Malia and Sasha, and one of the things I want them to do as they get older is to engage in issues they care about, even ones I may not agree with them on. I want them to be able to speak their mind in a civil and thoughtful way. And I don't want them attacked or called horrible names because they're being good citizens. And I wanted Sandra to know that that I thought her parents should be proud of her, and that we want to send a message to all our young people that being part of a democracy involves argument and disagreements and debate, and we want you to be engaged, and there's a way to do it that doesn't involve you being demeaned and insulted, particularly when you're a private citizen. All right. Jessica Yellen.
Mr. President.
Jessica.
Apologize for what they said about that.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Thank you.
Top Democrats have said that Republicans on a similar issue are engaged in a war on women. Some top Republicans say it's more like Democrats are engaged in a war for the women's vote. As you talk about loose talk of war in another arena, and women are, this could raise concerns among women, do you agree with the chair of your Democratic National Committee that there is a war on women?
Here's what I think. Women are going to make up their own mind in this election about who is advancing the issues that they care most deeply about. One of the things I've learned being married to Michelle is I don't need to tell her what it is that she thinks is important. And there are millions of strong women around the country who are going to make their own determination about a whole range of issues. It's not going to be narrowly focused just on contraception. It's not going to be driven by one statement by one radio announcer. It is going to be driven by their view of what's most likely to make sure they can help support their families, make their mortgage payments, who's got a plan to ensure that middle-class families are secure over the long term, what's most likely to result in their kids being able to get the education they need to compete. And I believe that Democrats have a better story to tell to women about how we're going to solidify the middle class and grow this economy, make sure everybody has a fair shot, everybody's doing their fair share, and we got a fair set of rules of the road that everybody has to follow. I'm not somebody who believes that women are going to be single-issue voters. They never have been. But I do think that we've got a strong story to tell when it comes to women.
Would you prefer this language be changed?
Jessica, as you know, if I start being in the business of arbitrating, and what I do is I practice it. I'm going to try to lead by example in this situation, as opposed to commenting on every single comment that's made by either politicians or pundits. I would be very busy. I would not have time to do my job. That's your job, to comment on what's said by politicians and pundits. All right. Lori Montenegro.
Thank you.
There you are.
Mr. President, polls are showing that Latino voters seem to be favoring your reelection over a Republican alternative, yet some of them are still disappointed, others upset about a promise that you made on immigration reform that has yet to come to pass. If you are reelected, what would be your strategy? What would you do different to get immigration reform passed through the Congress, especially if both houses continue as they are right now, which is split?
Well, first of all, just substantively, every American should want immigration reform. We got a system that's broken. We've got a system in which you have millions of families here in this country who are living in the shadows, worried about deportation. You've got American workers that are being undercut because those undocumented workers can be hired and the minimum wage laws may not be observed. Overtime laws may not be observed. You've got incredibly talented people who want to start businesses in this country or to work in this country. And we should want those folks here in the United States. But right now, the legal immigration system is so tangled up that it becomes very difficult for them to put down roots here. So we can be a nation of laws and a nation of immigrants. And it is not just a Hispanic issue. This is an issue for everybody. This is an American issue that we need to fix. Now, when I came into office, I said, I am going to push to get this done. We didn't get it done. And the reason we haven't gotten it done is because what used to be a bipartisan agreement that we should fix this ended up becoming a partisan issue. I give a lot of credit to my predecessor, George Bush, and his political advisors who said, you know, this should not be just something the Democrats support. The Republican Party is invested in this as well. That was good advice then. It would be good advice now. And my hope is that after this election, the Latino community will have sent a strong message that they want a bipartisan effort to pass comprehensive immigration reform that involves making sure we've got tough border security. And this administration has done more for border security than just about anybody. That we are making sure that companies aren't able to take advantage of undocumented workers. That we've got, you know, strong laws in place. And that we've got a path so that all those folks whose kids often are U.S. citizens, who are working with us, living with us, and in our communities, and not breaking the law, and trying to do their best to raise their families, that they've got a chance to be a fuller part of our community. So what do I think will change? What I will do, look, we're going to be putting forward, as we have done before, a framework, a proposal, legislation that can move it, move the ball forward and actually get this thing done. But ultimately, I can't vote for Republicans. They're going to have to come to the conclusion that this is good for the country and that this is something that they themselves think is important. And depending on how Congress turns out, we'll see how many Republican votes we need to get it done. Nora O'Donnell, how are you?
Thank you, Mr. President.
Today is Super Tuesday, so I wonder if you might weigh in on some of your potential Republican opponents. Mitt Romney has criticized you on Iran and said hope is not a foreign policy. He also said that you are America's most feckless president since Carter. Yeah. What would you like to say to Mr. Romney?
Good luck tonight.
No, really.
Really? Lynn, since you've been hollering and you're from my hometown, make it a good one.
My question is about the switch of the G8 summit from Chicago to Camp David.
Mm-hmm.
A reason given from the White House is that now you wanted a more intimate summit.
Yeah.
People in Chicago would like to know, what do you know now that you did not know when you booked hometown Chicago for the G8 that led to the switch? And what role did security threats possibly play in the decision?
Well, keep in mind, Lynn, we're still going to be showing up with a whole bunch of world leaders. We've got this NATO summit. Typically what's happened is that we've tried to attach the G8 summit to the NATO summit so that the leaders in the G8 summit don't have to travel twice to whatever location. So last year in France, we combined a G8 with a NATO summit. We'll do so again. I have to say this was an idea that was brought to me after the initial organizing of the NATO summit. Somebody pointed out that I hadn't had any of my counterparts who I've worked with now for 3 years up to Camp David. G8 tends to be a more informal setting in which we talk about a wide range of issues in a pretty intimate way. And the thinking was that people would enjoy being in a more casual backdrop. I think, the weather should be good that time of year. It'll give me a chance to spend time with Mr. Putin, the new Russian president. And from there, we will then fly to Chicago. I always have confidence in Chicago being able to handle security issues. Whether it's Taste of Chicago or Lollapalooza or Bulls Championships, we know how to deal with the crowd. And I'm sure that your new mayor will be quite attentive to detail in making sure that everything goes off well. All right? Okay. Go ahead. Last one.
Thank you.
Last question.
Thank you. Mr. President, just to continue on that, when the NATO leaders gather in mm-hmm. Chicago in May, do you expect that they'll be able to agree on a transition strategy? And are you concerned at all that the Quran burning and the episodes that have followed since then threaten your ability to negotiate with the partners?
Well, keep in mind that the transition policy was in place and established at Lisbon. And we've been following that strategy that calls for us turning over increasing responsibility to Afghans and a full transition so that our combat role is over by the end of 2014. And our coalition partners have agreed to it. They are sticking with it. That continues to be the plan. What we are now going to be doing over the next, at this NATO meeting and planning for the next 2 years, is to make sure that that transition is not a cliff, but that there are benchmarks and steps that are taken along the way in the same way that we reduced our role in Iraq so that it is gradual, Afghan capacity is built, the partnering with Afghan security forces is effective, that we are putting in place the kinds of support structures that are needed in order for the overall strategy to be effective. Now, yes, the situation with the Quran burning concerns me. I think that it is an indication of the challenges in that environment, and it's an indication that now is the time for us to transition. Obviously, you know, the violence directed at our people is unacceptable. And President Karzai acknowledged that. But what is also true is President Karzai, I think, is eager for more responsibility on the Afghan side. We're going to be able to find a mechanism whereby Afghans understand their sovereignty is being respected and that they're going to be taking a greater and greater role in their own security. That, I think, is in the interest of Afghans. It's also in our interests. And I'm confident we can execute, but it's not going to be a smooth path. There are going to be bumps along the road, just as there were in Iraq.
Well, are these bumps along the road, or are you seeing a deterioration in the relationship based on the Quran burning itself, the violence that has followed, that inhibits your ability to work out things like how to hand off the detention center?
No, none of this stuff is easy. And it never has been. And obviously, the most recent riots or protests against the Quran burning were tragic. But remember, this happened a while back when a pastor in Florida threatened to burn a Quran. In Iraq, as we were making this transition, there were constant crises that would pop up. And tragic events that would take place. And there would be occasional setbacks. But what I've tried to do is to set a course, make sure that up and down the chain of command, everybody knows what our broader strategy is. And one of the incredible things about our military is that when they know what our objective is, what our goal is, regardless of the obstacles that they meet along the way, they get the job done. And I think that President Karzai understands that we are interested in a strategic partnership with the Afghan people and the Afghan government. We are not interested in staying there any longer than is necessary to assure that al-Qaeda is not operating there and that there is sufficient stability that it doesn't end up being a free-for-all after ISAF has left. And so we share interests here. It'll require negotiations, and there will be time where things don't look as smooth as I'd like. That's kind of the deal internationally on a whole range of these issues. All right? Thank you, guys. Oh, can I just make one other comment? I want to publicly express condolences to the family of Donald Payne, congressman from New Jersey, a wonderful man, did great work both domestically and internationally. He was a friend of mine, and so my heart goes out to his family and to his colleagues. All right?
You're listening to live coverage of President Barack Obama from the Brady Press briefing room at the White House. I'm Jennifer Ludden in Washington. And President Obama there in his first news conference of the year took on a variety of questions, most of them in foreign policy, some of them on the domestic front. I'm joined here in studio 4B by NPR's diplomatic correspondent Michelle Kellerman, national political correspondent Mara Liasson, and NPR's national security correspondent Tom Gelton. Tom, Iran was probably the subject of most of the questions President Obama was asked about Israel's pressure on the U.S. to really kind of step up and support Israel if it chooses to kind of head off a nuclear program there. What did the president say?
Well, you're right, Jennifer. This came in the context of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu visiting Washington. And so, of course, Israel's position was very much front and center in the news. And then, of course, it's also in the context of a campaign season where, as the president pointed out, as the president acknowledged, Republican candidates have been pushing him to be more assertive. He was very dismissive of that talk from Republican candidates, calling it a lot of bluster, a lot of big talk. He said people who are popping off about war and talking about it casually don't have to deal with the consequences. I do. His message to Israel, I thought he sort of was backed off from some of the statements that we'd heard previously. He said that this notion that the United States has Israel's back did not amount to a military doctrine. It was just a restatement of the U.S. position. He emphasized again that there is a window of opportunity to solve this diplomatically. And he very pointedly said this idea that we have to make a decision in the next month or 2 months is just not right.
And Michelle Kellerman, when he says that there is an opportunity to resolve this diplomatically, what is happening on the diplomatic front with Iran?
So Iran recently said it was ready to negotiate, and the European Union's foreign policy chief answered that letter today, actually, and said that the U.S., the Europeans, the Russians and Chinese are ready to get back into these talks. President Obama today said, you know, don't expect any breakthroughs in the first meeting when they get it off the ground. But he said that we'll get a sense quickly about how serious the Iranians are. And he also talked about the pressure building on Iran, the isolation, the sanctions. He said they understand that the world community means business and that the onus is on them to prove that their intentions are peaceful.
He was actually asked about a statement he made 3 years ago when he said, you can't talk forever.
That's right. But here we are back again into this new round of negotiations. The sense that the U.S. and others are trying to present is that there's a lot more pressure now on the Iranians. Sanctions are crippling, and that maybe because of that, they'll come to the table in a more serious way. That's yet remains to be seen.
Mara, the president was also asked about pressure from some quarters to do more on Syria. Senator John McCain yesterday called for U.S. airstrikes there. And the president was asked if it's not a double standard. We intervened with Libya, but now we're not with Syria. What did the president say to that?
Yeah, he said this is a more complicated situation than in Libya. And, you know, I wanted to say something overall. This was a confident, happy president we saw. There was not one bit of defensiveness that I saw in this press conference, which sometimes you do. I think that on Syria, he feels his stance is completely defensible. Yes, some Republican senators are urging him to do more, but his opponents on the campaign trail are not. On Iran, he was able to say, you know, all these guys are out there talking big, but when you ask them what they would do, their answer is exactly what we've been doing for 3 years. So I think he feels very confident. He was able to say they're not the commander-in-chief. Whenever a president can say that, that's a good thing for him. And I think that the message, the body language, the change in tone that Tom just mentioned sends the message he is not being put in a box by Netanyahu. He's done what he needs to do in the last couple of days with the speech at AIPAC, with the meeting in the Oval Office. He's reasserted his commitment to Israel without getting boxed into any kind of a decision. When he was asked what it means to have Israel's back, the analogy he used was to Great Britain and Japan, which is if they're attacked, we come to their aid. Not if they want to launch an attack on someone, we automatically follow them.
So he also declined a couple of questions, opportunities to criticize his Republican opponents on the campaign trail.
Well, when asked what he would say to Mitt Romney, you know, because Romney's been criticizing him, what he would say to him today on Super Tuesday, he said, well, good luck tonight. That is exactly the right thing for him to say today. He has gone out of his way never to mention Romney's name, although he alludes to him indirectly in many speeches, and he's been very disciplined about that. He did take one big, fat softball question about Rush Limbaugh. I don't know how softer a softball could be, but of course he said the remarks that were made don't have a place in public discourse, and the reason he called Sandra Fluck he called her Fluke. Apparently her name is Fluke. Fluck. Fluke, like book, sorry. Is that he thought of Malia and Sasha. I mean, that was just, political. I can see the smiles on all the faces of the White House.
He was humanizing his position
in the lower press office watching him on television. So, yes.
He said he wanted them to be able to speak their mind in a civil way. He wanted to send a message to all young people that you should be able to speak out without being attacked.
Yes. And he also avoided the question, do you agree with your party chair that the Republicans are engaged in a war on women? He wouldn't touch that with a 10-foot pole.
He was also asked about immigration. We didn't really learn much new there. He said he'll come up with legislation. When asked what you would do different, he'll say, well, let's see what kind of a Congress is elected, how many Republicans we have to persuade. Asked a few words about Afghanistan, but mostly it was really about Iran and his insistence that we do not have to rush into any military action there. You've been listening to live special coverage of President Barack Obama's first news conference of the year. I'm Jennifer Ludden. It's NPR.